let's get started. I'm going to take the first minute or so just to finish up on something we had yesterday. A number of you were here. Those of you who were here the last session, man, that's a hard act to follow. Brunel over here playing away on the piano and all of that stuff. Man, that was educational, entertaining, good music, everything all in one. Well, sorry, folks. My wife suggested I go over and play chopsticks to show that I can play the piano too. But we won't do that. Anyway, but as a few people come, just at the end of the hour yesterday, we were talking about the Mediterranean environment and all kinds of things about that. It goes back to biblical time. But we showed some pictures, and any of you who've traveled to anywhere in the Mediterranean know right now, it's a very rocky landscape, and we showed some slides like that and indicated how that was destruction, and it became a catalyst for people to warn Americans, look what great civilizations unknowingly or can do to an environment. And several people talked to me after and asked, can that be restored? And the answer essentially is no, not within human time. At this point, because of the damage done there, that's the way it will be almost for geologic time. And so I wanted to read, those of you who got the handout, I just wanted to read, 15 lines out of that. To one who is familiar with the present-day landscapes around the Mediterranean Sea, a vision of almost unbroken forest from the water's edge up to the crests of all but the highest mountains may seem too fantastic for credence. Today, wherever cultivated fields and orchards do not occupy the ground, scrub, poor grassland, or bare rock are almost universal. Ecological investigations have indicated that the scantiness of this vegetation cover is mainly due to human activity. People have cultivated crops and herded animals around much of the Mediterranean Sea for several millennia. It is perhaps difficult to believe that such wholesale changes as those envisaged here have actually taken place. And then the one paragraph, again, those of you who got the handout, but it's a way to sort of remind us about the totality of environmental stuff. This author, Mr. Iyer, wrote, with the felling or grazing of the forest, the whole hydrologic system, along with the microclimate near the surface of the soil, was utterly changed. We made the point, all of us around here, it's warm, hot out here today on the driveway, but once you get in the forest, whoa, you drop a bunch of degrees, and it's really comfortable. Well, think of that, even in a warmer place such as the Mediterranean. Soil, which had never been thoroughly exposed during the whole of its evolution, because of the tree cover, could now be desiccated to a considerable depth by only a few days of summer sun and wind. Also, the leaf fall, which had persistently supplied new humus to the surface layers, was now cut off. No longer were nutrients being drawn from deep within the weathering rock to be brought back to the soil by leaf decay. The nutrient cycle was thus altered, as well as the hydrologic one. The fertility of the soil fell rapidly. The spongy, brown, deep forested soils lost their structure as the humus, the decaying plant animal material, as the humus content decreased, and instead of being absorbed and passed downwards into storage, the winter rains ran off the surface in ever-increasing sheets and rivulets, carrying the soil particles with them. In a frighteningly short period of time, bare rock probably appeared at the surface on many slopes, and where pockets remained, those were deficient in humus and prone to drought. And so then, as people ask me, can that return? Even in Illinois, we're able to say, which is flat land, that the, and I'm going to say more about this stuff on Thursday, but the rate of soil formation, and so therefore it's what they will allow for soil loss, is that we think of a sustainable soil environment. In Illinois, relatively flat, moderate seasonality, not like the Mediterranean, the rate of soil formation is about the equivalent of 3 sheets of paper a year. All right. And they calculate that you can lose about 3 tons of soil per acre per year, and the soil will be sustainable. So, and a ton is if you could have equipment that would scrape about the thickness of a sheet of paper off of a football field. If you had equipment that could do that, you'd have a ton of soil. And so therefore, that means if we take the 3 sheets that I have in my hand, that's about the rate of soil loss per year that we can tolerate, which, to go back at the other lower end of the soil profile, that's about all the soil that we're creating in a year in a favorable environment. So you put some of those pictures I showed at the end of the hour in perspective, and real rocky landscapes, it's done. It's over for all practical purposes. Yeah, it could start a little soil collecting between these rocks and that, but now you're talking about how much are rocks going to erode quickly to become soil formation. It takes a long enough time in the Luss and glacial till that Larry told us about last night, which makes Illinois soils pretty good, but that's already unconsolidated material. It takes a long time there. You get in a rocky environment. So that would be the case around here. You know, if we don't have the warm temperatures, but imagine with this kind of forest cover, if you cleared all of that off and the trees were all carted off and we had the winter rains and everything else, it wouldn't take too long to wash away some of these little places where soil forms. And now some of the hard rock we see along these trails, that can take a long time to start to form a new widespread soil profile. So anyway, we've got to talk about other things, but I wanted to at least follow that up because a few people asked, could this be restored? No, and that's why we don't want to let that kind of stuff happen other places. Well, today we're switching gears, and we're talking today about the idea of environmental decision-making. And I want to put up then, immediately, on the screen, let's see, we just had the transparency, put it back up here. This is a decision-making model that I teach regularly, and it's not because this is a church college. This is used widely by a number of, at least some geographers who studied with Gilbert White, and I know there's somebody in Colorado who uses this and scattered around the country. Gilbert White was such a modest person, he never told us everyone should learn my model. But he was such a good instructor at the University of Chicago, and he's had such a successful career of being involved in public decision making, not just being an academic, that we all thought this is a pretty good model to use. And so I learned it in the 60s, and others learned it in the 70s, and now you see books published in the 1990s and in the early 2000s, and lo and behold, there shows up the Gilbert White model. And I do have a handout for you on this, so you don't have to take notes on it, and it's the same one that you see here. What White said, that anytime you make decisions, first of all, sitting outside of that is the term perception. No one in the world is objective. No one is. And so therefore, the rest of the variables that you can see here, and that I'll identify a little bit more, to arrive at, and by the way, White, when he introduced this, was not so much a way for us to think in the forward. Gilbert White was trying to help people understand, why do people in this part of the earth make decisions like this? Why do people over there or another part of the country make decisions like that? And in some cases, they were similar environments, but very different uses. Why did these people choose to use an environment like this way, and people in a different place with an almost similar environment make decisions and end up doing something different? His point was, as we look forward in decision making, we kind of have to look backward. What are the factors that make people, societies, communities, states, whatever, decide what they want to do? What are the factors? And so he said, sitting outside of this is perception. Everybody is unobjective. And so therefore, you have to try and realize that there are going to be the people involved in, and I don't mean just the decision making, but the people involved in an environment. Maybe they are the owners. Maybe they are the visitors. Maybe they are the people at the state capitol who are making decisions about the place. Maybe they're young people who want to use this environment for 50 years. Maybe they're old people who are hoping that they can have a good 10 or 20 years left with it, wherever it is. Everybody has different background. And that sits outside and it influences every other variable that comes up. And so he said, if that's the case, we better study. And I'm proud that our discipline really was really the leaders geographers of all people who developed this phrase, the study of the perception of the environment. And at first developed, White was working a lot with floods. And so he tried to figure out, why are there some people who want to live right next to a river, even though they know it's going to flood? Why do they do this? And okay, they survive one flood, and you people, scientists, could warn them, you could have more of these. That's okay, they dry out their furniture and their carpets, and they're right back there again. And they would say, well, some of those people would say, yeah, okay, we'll just put up with that risk. But look, we get to put our canoe in here, there's a nice cool breeze coming off the river, we can fish from the deck, we can do all of that stuff most of the time. But yeah, okay, there's some flooding, it's inconvenience, and yeah, the city or somebody will help come and rescue us and get us some food, get us some shelter, or help us disconnect the electric wires. Why do people do that? And so White got this going, and really in the 1950s at University of Chicago, and it came to spread around the country. A real interest in knowing that what counts in decision making is as much this perception. Perception more important than reality, then. You can have all the details that you would want to do that. And so we did a lot, and then psychology also began to look at that. And so at Augustana, for maybe first 7-8 years that I taught there, it was a team taught course between a geographer and a psychologist. And people might wonder, what in the world do they have in common? Well, I could understand the nature of floods and what the odds are in that, and then the psychologist person knows that there are some people in this room who don't want to go anywhere near anything that's risky. You may not even want to climb up to Holden Lake because there's still a lot of snow on the ground and maybe we could slip and fall and so on. Others would say, oh, that's all right, I'll take my chances. If I slip, I slip. Now, why do we have that variation in a room? Why do we have that variation any place? And that's why then you got to figure out why are some people's minds inclined to be risky and others are not. Don't ask a geographer to get into the human mind on that. So you see geography and the other come together to look at perception. We could talk a long time about that. The next variable though, White said, first thing you want to look at are what are the range of choices that people perceive. If you're really aiming, now as we look forward, if you're really hoping to get, let's say, any kind of decision that might be in our minds, one of the things we'd want to know is, for each of us, what are the choices that are even, you're even in your mind? Or if there's a community struggling, what should we do with our waterfront? Or people wanting to do, what should we do with our urban forest? You somehow want to find out, what are the things that you're even aware of? Because maybe you could go through a whole committee, a community session like what we have here, and maybe it would turn out that I might know, as an outside expert coming in on something, I might know of some alternatives that none of you ever thought of. That you're not aware of what's going on in Portland or what's going on in Phoenix or someplace like that. So White said, you got to figure out what's even in people's perception as to the possible choices. And in that case, then he said, if you find out they aren't aware of a lot of choices, then the first thing in decision making is, at least you got to put in front of the people the choices that conceivably could be there. So you're hoping then to stretch the range of choices. If you find out from the first study they are only aware of A through G, and really there should be A through N, then we got to find a way to get those G through N alternatives in front of people. So you want to figure out that. And some people are often very aware of what the alternatives are. And in other places, whether here or overseas in a developing situation, they may not just perceive much at all. Just a quick, so one of our grads went in the Peace Corps, and he was trying to get people to work on some soil management. Paul Osmond, he's now the head of floodplain management in the state of Illinois, but he went over to Kenya, and he, people didn't want to listen to him certain things, but he wanted to have a little garden on his own. And so he had a steep slope like this, and Paul knew you don't want to plant rows up and down, you want to plant them on the contour. And so he planted on the contour, and people then wondered, what are you planting like that for? And he said, well, we're going to cut down the erosion, and sure enough, at the end of the year, Paul, in his little private garden, he had some pretty nice vegetable crops that had developed. And the people out in the village said, they, the soil was washing away like mad. They didn't perceive, they'd never heard of the idea that, gee, maybe if you have a slope going like this, maybe you want to have your rows going perpendicular so that'll slow down the water. Well, Paul found that out. The next year, farmers in that area were starting to do contour farming. They'd never perceived it, and that's what you try to do. The next one is an easy one to move on. I guess I left it out of the list here, but it's natural process. And this is where a lot of the people who will take my course, they come from biology department or geology department or something like that. They're scientist people. And when they, as soon as we get into my class, the first day they find out, yeah, we're going to talk about some natural processes, but that's only going to be one variable. We're going to get into all the rest of these things. So, but one of the things you certainly need to know, what are the natural processes that could be involved in an issue? So you got to bring in your scientists. But then you also want to figure out how do people perceive those processes. It's one thing to say you've got a 100-year flood or a 1% flood, but now what do people think when they hear about the 1% flood? So they're both important. All the way through, perception is there, but so is the variable by itself. So natural processes, and we're not going to go through all of that. Every problem would have a whole set of different processes. We're going to look at some of them on Thursday. Technology. What's the technology that's available that could possibly help us to solve this? Somebody may have this idea. Do we have the technology to carry out that idea? So here's where you get your engineers involved. But it also becomes a perception thing, because there may be some in this room who believe, we've heard technology is going to solve our problems for 30 or 40 years, and I just don't trust it. And then there are others who say, I'm not that worried about the future, because look at what we've been able to do with our technological development so far, and we've developed magnificent things, and so who are we to say that by 2040 we might not have some unbelievable technological breakthroughs? So don't be too upset about that. Everyone in this room has a different perception on how much we're going to trust technology. So you can ask, what's the technology that's available? And then figure out the people who would be involved in this decision making. What do they perceive about it? So once again, you would come to the conclusion, if you know that somehow this technology is okay, but 75% of the people in this community don't trust technology, well, then you may want to hold off on the time to introduce this new idea till there can be a little bit more education about the solid quality of this technology. And so you, again, look at it that way. Economics is another one. We're going to have some Christian examples of that in a minute. Obviously, every decision, if it's going to work, needs to be economically feasible. Somehow, it has to be a variable. This sometimes is tough to get across to biologists who will take my class, who absolutely, they know what this is, and if you don't allow that to happen, or if we don't do it this way, it's not going to be a good thing. And then I have to say, yeah, but if it's economically impossible, you'll never get the state government, city government, or whoever, or private corporation to adopt it. It somehow has to be suitable for both. And then they sort of accuse you, you're sold to economists, but in this case, somehow you got to get a decision. And you got to work that out. It has to be affordable, or it won't go in our society or any places. So you look at that. But that also is influenced by perception. And I learned an illustration, when I use it in class, people get upset about it. There's a concept called satisficing, and that would be the perception of economics. For some of you in the room, if I could tell you the same with investment, if I can take all your money and I can guarantee that you're going to get a 1% return, well, the way things are now, some of you might take that. But normally, many of you would say, that's ridiculous. How about 3%? How about 5? There are probably some in the room, particularly middle age or younger, who would say, no, a 3% return on any investment, that's terrible. I ought to be getting 7, 8, 9, or maybe even double digit. Everybody in the room has a different perception of what is economically feasible. Well, a fellow named, I think, Paul Samuelson also came up with the idea of satisficing. So you finally come to the conclusion, you can't keep on looking at economics for everything, all down to the last detail. Finally, you reach a point and you say, given what we know, this is the best we can speculate economically. Then I use the example when you pick a spouse. Do you really know when you go to the altar and you say, you are the only one in the world that is matched up with me? And of course, then the students say, oh, this is terrible. What's he talking about? This doesn't he love his wife? anything else. But every one of us in the room, if you look at it, finally we looked around and we had different relationships. And finally, we didn't say it this way, but we finally said, I give up. This is the best that we can do. You're not going to call the next 6.7 billion people to make sure you have the right one. And then they say, oh, terrible. But you get the idea. You can't continue to search the planet for the right economic decision, so you finally agree on certain limitations that are there. The next one is the true geographical one, spatial linkages. And that simply means, and White was, White got along very well with resource economists, but he knew that most economists work at what we might say the firm level or the individual property level, rather than if you really took into account, and I sometimes use the example of apples in Washington and now in China, if they're making a decision about what should we do with the apple growers in Washington, well, if we do this, we're going to get some benefits and costs. I will bet that the people in Washington aren't thinking, you know, if we do this, we may put the apple growers in Michigan out of business. They're not going to be thinking that. Or if we grow the apples here, that may put more pressure on the Idaho orchards. Probably aren't thinking about that. Now, White said, okay, don't fight with economists and tell them they got to have a broader view of the economic picture. Let's admit that they're going to be more local, but then let's add this extra variable. And that's where we as geographers should bring that to the table. If you make any decision in a place, what are the spatial linkages? If this farmer puts in a farm pond, don't maybe ask that farmer to do the calculation about what that's going to mean on the next farmer's land. But geographers then sitting around the table say, if you build that pond there, that's going to have some impact on the next farmer down the way. And so you want to bring the spatial linkages variable into the decision. And again, then here's where you'll get in the latter part, then finally you say, oh, that has sense the spatial connections, but I don't care. What's the perception about that? And that's what we're going to deal with for the bulk of the hour remaining. Social guides one and two, they're always going to be influenced. The decision is going to be influenced by laws and influenced by societal values and norms. Now, Gilbert White actually had that outside the parentheses. But I'm proud our students, one of the first years that I was using this model, they said, yeah, but why, the laws also are impacted by people's perception. Speed limit says 65 miles on it. How many if we're going 65? Geez, 72 is probably okay. Which means we're basically saying, I can ignore the law a little bit. And so therefore, even laws, the students argued, are subject to perception. And I think they were right. And so I've always included in here. Also, societal norms and values, it's hard to know how can you actually measure that, and then there would be the perception about it. So this is the model. Now, what I thought in preparing this initially, actually, for Pastor Marty's congregation in Davenport, Iowa, when I first did this, let's think of the ways, and it actually is in my mind, it's not like whenever I teach this class, I'm regularly talking about, now how can you be a Christian in deciding these things? And so everything I'm telling you today, I bring up it, that what I think is a Christian perspective without really saying to use the word, because I don't want them to, okay, now go to Augustana College and here's putting some religion into this thing. I'm not afraid to add that. But let's look at this model in a way in which we can see how the Christian perspective comes into the picture. Oh, one more example here at the beginning to show how I use this, and this is only going to be on the screen in a minute. What I tell students to do, they have to identify a resource issue, a problem, and then for the term, they're supposed to come up with possible range of choice. And then they have to use the Gilbert model, and this is the way, in this case, it was a problem, what can we do with some of the, somehow trying to figure out some way that they can deal with some urban sprawl issues. And so you have the range of choices, and then I ask them to do as much analysis as they can to see whether or not this gets a favorable rating in terms of we have the technology available, what are the spatial impacts, what are the legal aspects, and then in this case they only use two different kinds of perceptions. I usually like to have them find more, And ideally, you'd like to scan a table like this and then find the one that has pluses all the way across. And that way, that should be the right decision. It's economically feasible, it's okay with the environment and all of that. So that's what we try to do. And this is that model that we looked at. If we think of it now in a Christian context, let's do these sort of one at a time. When we think, first of all, of the perception variable, everyone has different perceptions. No one is objective. Then we have to think, do the perceptions of others count? There are some people who, in decision making, say, well, yeah, but there are neighbors. These are always going to object. Moline, Illinois, right? There's a contrast between Rock Island and Moline, Illinois. They're right next to each other. I don't think we have anybody here from Moline, so I can pick on them. But there really is a difference.
You have one.
Oh, we have one.
Yeah.
But often, often Moline has, this is where John Deere is. And their decision makers often sort of what John Deere wants, and even there's a group that's, they're sort of called sort of Renew Moline. These are the people that are sort of people of some stature in the community. Business people, perceived civic leaders. And it sort of permeates so much of what they do that the city hall, and they're good people, I mean, these are all really terrific folks. The mayor, the city council, and these decision makers, somehow that will help shape the future of the town. How about the people that live in the poor part of town? They're not usually on most of those committees, other than the council person who's there. And even when you meet with them, there was a meeting not too long ago, and they said, well, yeah, you can listen to all the people, but when it comes down to it, you have to stick with the people who are the leaders. Rock Island, right nearby, takes a philosophy which I would say is sort of closer, at least to my interpretation of the scripture. Right? It's bottom-up planning. You involve the whole community in this thing. And the first sessions are ones where you've got, you, and we go out of our way to get people from this neighborhood block and that group and the community caring conference and the union people and the public school people and the people from the Martin Luther King Center. They're all sort of there. And what is it that we want to happen? And it sort of bubbles up to the top. That would be a way of saying in this decision-making model, perception of everyone's view counts. Everybody deserves to be heard. Now to me, to Jesus, no one is irrelevant. And so if one really believes that sense, that everyone's view counts, the poorest person in town, the most minority person, whatever in town, their view about such things, even as the future of the city, ought to be listened to. At least they ought to be brought into the process. And then make an effort. You're always going to have to end up with compromise, but at least they're brought into the process. And so we preach that a lot. I say preach here because I think the planning profession does that, thank goodness. Not just because I'm speaking here, but you read the planning texts, and the word that's now used is stakeholders. And that's basically, for the stuff I'm involved with, urban planning and land use management, everybody is a stakeholder one way or another, and so therefore, you try to find out what the perceptions are of a lot of people. Everyone has perceptions and has a right to be heard. So you could see now, I think, for two people, I mean, diametrically opposed kind of situation. If you had a person who's not Christian at all, they'd say, well, all right, listen to him, just got to move forward with the decision. And if you had at the other extreme, some person would say, everybody's got to be heard. I think those of us in this room, I would hope, would say, we want to listen to everybody because I think we're not supposed to rank people and we should get them involved. This is also a case, and I'm going to say a little bit more, but there's a growing movement for the last 16 years. It started earlier, but it really came to the fore in 1994 in something called environmental racism. And I'm going to mention that in a couple of variables down. And that is where often decisions are made, where in terms of where we should have things and whose few should be counted. We had one situation, just to set it up even now, and it was in the west end of Rock Island, which tends to be lower income and often minority. somebody suggested that'd be a good place to put in a toxic waste recycling plant. And they assured us, and they were right, they had the technology. Once they got things in that building, providing there was no tremor or anything else, that toxic waste probably would be treated okay. But the neighbors, correctly, their perceptions were heard. They spoke up, and they said, yeah, but what happens if something happens to one of the many trucks that are going to be bringing in this toxic waste? And there's a little bit of spill in the driveways, or a little bit gets into the streets. Well, that shouldn't happen. Yeah, but what happens if it will? Would you, and then they were poignant and right to the point, and asked, would you put this up in our area, a place called like Watch Hill, which is a fancy neighborhood, it even sounds that way, or how about in this neighborhood and that? No, we wouldn't do that. Then don't put it in our place. You can't just assume because ours is the poor, lower income place that that's the place where, if possible, there could be an environmental leak. And we heard and we voted it down. The owner himself, a minority, was absolutely ticked off. Why won't you let me do that? I gave you all the assurances, but it ended up coming down. Fortunately, Rock Island at that point said, if we can't put that same building in the rich person's neighborhood in this town, then we can't put it down there. So we said no. Again, I was just one little voice out of many, so I'm not patting myself on the back at all here. But that was, in my mind, that was a Christian decision to listen to that. All right, the next variable. If we look at this one, care for all creation. Oh man, I don't think we have to spend too much time on that because I think especially here, we all recognize and we hear it all the time as Christians, our responsibility is to care for God's creation. Therefore, it would mean, I would think, all Christians are involved in somehow wanting to have sustainable use, that term that's now used a lot, for our children, for our grandchildren, for our great-grandchildren, forever. And the Endangered Species Act then even looks out for the smallest in the creation. And therefore, if we care about creation, that seems to me we support the smallest of creatures that somehow we don't want to put extinct forever. But you know, in our perception model, developers can't stand the Endangered Species Act. They say, we've got to jump through this hoop and that hoop and that hoop and so on and so forth. And you say, well, you want to do that just to make sure that they say, yeah, but it's just taking so much time, let's just get on with the project. I think if, from my point of view, if one's a Christian on something like this, you want to do everything you can to make sure you're not going to put any species out, you're not going to upset the hydrologic cycle too badly, the soil cycle. You're going to try and do that. Why? Because you want it to be as good for the grandkids as it is for us and for their grandkids down the road. We need to know that. We need, and so therefore, in order to do that, there's a commitment. We got to do everything we can to find out what the natural processes are. And that's why I'm always delighted when we get like lawyers and people from our political science department and some people in business who take my class. Because they know when I open my mouth what I'm going to say. But what really counts is if you can get some lawyers and politicians and business leaders who will speak up and say, you know, before we do this, we've got to make sure we're not upsetting the natural process. And that's a delight when those people are in the class, because those are going to be the people that in the community that can maybe carry some influence.
No. Good question. You had mentioned as you were talking about this about not affecting the cycle too badly. You said not affecting the hydrologic cycle too badly.
Well, to not affect it, ideally. That's right, and there are ways to work with it.
That's perception. When you're talking about perception, when you say too badly, it's like, well, we're going to compromise. We're going to upset it a little.
No, right. You don't want to upset it at all, but there are some which are drastically changed. And more than likely, there are always going to be some changes in natural process. It's almost impossible to deal with. I agree, I don't want to change it at all, right. And that's what you hope for in the long run. But if for sure you want to stop something that is blatantly going to change it, and so get it within what we would say that tolerable range, if that's the case.
I'm just wondering, where do you, how, along that spectrum, somebody makes a decision, says, this is going to be bad enough, we're not going to do it over here.
My point of view is just you don't want to change it at all. No, I would say you've got to make sure that hydrologic cycle is sustained. We're going to talk about that with groundwater and that kind of stuff later. You should, the same thing we said with soil. You should only allow that amount of erosion so that it can exactly be replaced. That's what I'm thinking. Please.
That's why it's taken 14 years to finally arrive at a program for remediation to show to the public.
Oh, yeah.
Because I just what you said, what's that, where's that line along there? What's going to disturb the most?
Some other cultures have some blatant mistreatment and slaughter of animals, and we try to say people to accept cultures as they are, and I have great respect and spent a lot of time in China, but that's one point on the way they take care of the animals that I sometimes get pretty upset at the way the Chinese long-term customs, having nothing to do with the communist government that does this. So anyway, we all see that that is a place. It's interesting in terms of the care for the land use management text that I use. That it's a big text, and it says there are three key concepts to be considered in land use management. And one of them is watersheds, to make sure, and that we'll look at that again on Thursday if you don't know what a watershed is, the whole area that drains to a point. You've got to make sure your environmental decision making does not upset watersheds. Second, ecosystems. And the third is community, actually, which gets into human environment stuff. But those, and this is that this becomes the, and again, this is mainline press used widely across the country in land use management classes. But you got to learn watersheds, you got to know ecosystem concepts, and you got to know a sense of community, both animal communities and human environment communities. Then we come to a really key one, and that is externalities, spatial linkages. They are always there. Every decision that you and I make is going to have impact on adjacent properties. If I, in a positive sense, so you can have sometimes positive externalities. We plant some flowers on the west side of our house. They're not very fancy houses. We never look at the west side of the house. It's as close to the neighbor's driveway as here. It's right there. We could almost reach out and shake hands with the people coming home. We plant some flowers there. We hardly ever see them. But that means that those neighbors, when they come home in their car, they see the flowers. That's a positive externality. Now, some of you may live next to neighbors who do nice things with their property. You're glad they're neighbors. You're getting a positive benefit. It increases not only the value of your property, but your daily enjoyment. Maybe you've got neighbors who do not such good things. So they are always there. There's always going to be some impact of the land use on this parcel on adjacent ones. And so then it becomes a case of what do we think about it? And that is at the core of our discipline. All parties are part of something, all properties are part of something more. We have a program linked with Duke University, and then Norm Christensen down at Duke, he's terrific, biologist. And he uses the image of a beautiful quilt. But the thing that makes the quilt beautiful are patches, the patches that make up the quilt. And so Norm Christensen is a biologist down at Duke. He tells those biologists who might be inclined to be focused on the patch, and that is, what are all the species in this wetland, or what are all the species in this floodplain habitat, or on this particular slope? He tells them, you got to know how that patch fits into the whole quilt, the externalities. Now, for us as geographers, we're always looking at externalities, but we got to tell them, you got to go down and take some biology courses so you can really understand what's happening in the patch. Real good science that way. But that's a recognition that these go together. Now, how does this jump to Christianity? And on this, I want to read just a few lines from a wonderful, I mean, I've been talking about this a long time, but this was an article just in a group called, a magazine called Intersections, spring of 2009, written by Wanda Diefeld, a professor of religion at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. She says, a Lutheran reflection on civic responsibility, accountability, and commitment toward the well-being of others fosters an understanding of vocation as a call to citizenship. In his writings, Martin Luther spells out that to be a Christian is to live not in oneself, but with an utmost concern for our neighbor. Then quoting from Luther's article, one of Luther's documents. The good things we have from God should flow from one to the other and be common to all, so that everyone should put on his neighbor, and so conduct himself toward him as he himself were in the other's place. Another line that comes from this, from Luther's Freedom, quote, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind and your neighbor as yourself. The fulfillment of the law in its civic or political use is a requirement for all Christians because it guides, compels, protects, and leads to good works. Luther's commentary, the law, therefore, is the basis for a just society and serves as a constant reminder of our social responsibilities, we would say externalities. Again, quoting Luther, Luther summarizes his position, quote, a true Christian lives and labors on earth not for himself but for his neighbor. Therefore, the whole spirit of his life impels him to do even that which he need not do, but which is profitable and necessary for his neighbor. Another one, the concern for the well-being of neighbor, as Luther spells out, is the basis for an ethic of care. To care for another human being is to assure dignity in life and abundance, act for justice and peace, and enable that another may flourish as a full human being created in the image of God. It implies a genuine concern for the neighbor's needs, and so on. There was a wonderful article, also a short article in the Lutheran a year ago, written in that case by Cap Johnson, LCA pastor and attorney who teaches business at California Lutheran, and he argues the same points. So it seems to me when Christians ask, what the scientists will determine what are the externalities, then it seems to me in the decision-making process, the Christian steps in and says, we should care about that. So if I'm doing something bad on my farm that's having an impact there, I got to think about that. Somebody else may say, that's tough. There's always going to be, somebody's always going to lose. I got to do this to my property, or I got to do this to my business, or it won't make it. And if that happens, well, you can't win. I think Christians would do everything they could to say, I do care about those externalities, and is there any way you can do something about it? There was a Catholic group in the Quad Cities that wanted to, there were some neighbors, had some homes, imagine, almost lined up where these pieces of wood are. Big piece of property over here, and a Catholic social service group, they wanted to put in a kind of a retirement center. Well, it's a good thing. Well, it turns out they wanted to have this whole space be open, and they ended up wanting to put the building about as close to the property line as possible. And they said, look, this is going to be a good thing for social service. Well, they had the neighbors there, the good people, they weren't real happy to suddenly look and know that right outside their window they were going to have a six-story building with for whoever in this retirement community. Well, to show how it can work, the city and the Catholic people and those of us on the Planning Commission, people got down and turns out they said, yeah, now you make a good point. I think we'll put the building over on that side. Now everybody's happy. Now you got the retirement center. These neighbors, they don't care. Yeah, they used to have woods here and they wish they still had woods, but okay, things change. But we have this over there, the open space is here, the city did its job, and I would say in some measure that was Christian decision-making. Care for the neighbor. Those Catholic people, they did hear what those six or seven homeowners. But you can imagine in some circles, people would have said, look, there are only seven homeowners. We're going to have a six-story building. We're going to have a lot of people here. Greatest good for the greatest number. That's what we got to do. They could have done that, and they probably would have won out because they were within the law. They were like that. And we would have, I might have voted it down, but city council might have approved it, maybe. And somebody else might have taken it to court and may have said that's not, no, but the Catholic folks listened, yeah, well, let's make this work. I think that's critical to this, and we could go on with some other examples. I want to cite just a few from our community. Leaf burning, the Quad Cities is a case where we've got Illinois and Iowa, Rock Island, Moline, Davenport, Bettendorf. Davenport and Bettendorf are on the north side of the river. In October, most of the winds are still from the south. They passed, Davenport and Bettendorf passed leaf burning ordinances way before, several years before Moline and Rock Island. And some of us with some Christian orientation and others with just general sensitivity said, this is not fair. They passed the ordinance forcing their people to bag leaves, but those of us on the other side didn't pass that, so which way is the smoke going? So now people in Davenport and Iowa and Bettendorf who wanted clean air, they're getting stuck with our air. It took a while, but finally Rock Island and Moline have leaf burning ordinances. It should have happened earlier than that if people would have been thinking about my neighbor. And I don't mean just aesthetics. Those are people who have asthmatic conditions over there. So how could Rock Island and Moline continue to persist and let dirty air go that way? Yeah, I would say you bring that into the perspective, and if you had a whole city council of people with, I would say, a Christian orientation, it would have passed years before, because they would have been worried about that. Flood control, funny story. Out in the west here, and I think our session is supposed to end not at 4:45, we'll end at 5, but it was right on the border of Utah and Arizona. Janet and I were traveling there. I don't play golf. We came into the Sound Team, St. George's, Utah, and we wanted to get some information, and the woman said, would you fill out a survey for us? We're glad to have you here. And I said, what's the survey about? Well, we have one golf course, and we're thinking we maybe should have a second one. And I said, no, we're just visiting, and I play tennis. I don't play golf. No, that's okay. Please fill that out. And I said, really? I don't think you want me filling that out. Well, why don't you want me filling that out? I said, well, I know that the water that you're going to use for this takes water to have a good golf course. And if you take that out, that's going to mean less water going to Arizona, and that's going to be a problem for them. And honest folks, the woman in this visitor center said, oh, the hell with Arizona. And I said, okay, I think I will fill out that survey. You see the point, though. Again, if that would have been some Christian folks, I hope I'm not simplifying too much the Christian perspective, but I think if people in St. George's, Utah were actually thinking about their neighbors, they might think twice about using more water, depriving people down the watershed of that. Last example of this was in the Quad Cities again. With a past, and again, I'm active in the church, my brother's here, he's a clergyman, my father was a clergyman, so I wasn't trying to. But we passed a stormwater ordinance, and maybe many of your communities have to pass, everybody in the country has to have them in place by 2017, functioning so that the water that's not the water that's going through your sewers, but the water that's running off your lawns, your properties, whatever. Somehow you have to have a plan for that. In Rock Island, we developed a system where it would depend on the amount of impervious surface that you have in your yard. And of course, then average homeowners, they generalized, and then that would mean for schools, institutions, parking lots, and so on, there was going to be a slightly extra charge so that we have a stormwater fee. Well, I got a call from and church parking lots are often pretty good size, but I got a call from a pastor, because I'm on the planning commission, and he said, oh, Mr. Moline, he said, I know you're going to be voting on this thing, and you know, I'm from this church, and we're a nonprofit group, and I said, excuse me, pastor, but let me interrupt. I said, I know what you're going to say, and I said, I assure you, I'm from a pastoral family, so I know somehow what Christian traditions are. I know that if that water goes off, if you have that whole property paved, which it is, there's a lot of water that's running off, and Rock Island can't allow that to happen, and therefore we have to charge everyone the fee proportion to the amount of hard surfaces, because if you don't pay for that, the city still is going to have to treat that stormwater. And so I said, Pastor, one of the things I know we learned in the church is, are we our brother's keepers? And I think, therefore, if your church was caring for your brothers, you wouldn't want to do that to your neighbors. Thank you. And he hung up. That was it. The end of the conversation. And we got one other call like that. The churches felt they should somehow be exempt. And I wasn't being flippant about it. Church parking lots are big. And there's a lot of rainwater that hits that quickly goes into the system. And if the churches don't find a way within their budgets to pay for that, it's basically saying, my neighbors are going to have to pay for it. It's an externality. We got to watch out for that. The next one is public nuisance, and I'm not going to say much about that. Societal values and norms, this is all the way through. Who are, as we said, there's a lot of who knows what actually about society believes. But I think if Christians speak up, even without necessarily using the word, I'm saying this as a Christian, but if one begins to speak out on some of these things, then when the vote is taken, or when the surveys are taken. What are we and the people in Seattle or in Portland or in Idaho or Illinois, what do they think about that? If enough Christians are thinking about the issues, lo and behold, the perception of what society thinks about this may begin to take on something that would be kind of consistent with our caring for our brothers and neighbors in creation kind of values. If we don't speak up, if Christians don't get involved, then people who are more of a selfish bent or whatever, that will come to be perceived by the elected officials as this is what our society wants. I admit here, and I probably step on thin ground, I have never voted against a tax increase, not once. And I'm actually proud to say that, because I treasure everything that's happening around me, the good streets, the schools, the parks, whatever's going on. Yeah, there's some waste and so on, but I'm sure glad that I got all that stuff around. Here, I'm right where Bill Gates is, where he said, you know, he has to pay over 50% tax, but he said he gave business people a choice. I can let you start your business in Ethiopia, and you won't have any tax, or I'll let you start here and pay 50% of your tax. Anybody going to decide they want to go to Ethiopia? Because he said that he's able to do what he does because of things around. Well, but if people begin to perceive that everybody just wants the taxes and so their money for themselves, then what does that say about the larger thing? It's, I know we get tread some thin ground there. But last in this story is when we get to the economics, and I intentionally save this because these are the people who, and most of the concepts I share on this, by the way, come from an economics text. So this is not from environmental people or Christian people or whatever. This is from an environmental text. They do have in economic discussions, in microeconomics, the term of externalities. And the goal there, even in economist texts, would be that somehow they should try to minimize externalities. The same concept we've talked about spatially. But even the economists would say we should try to minimize them. We shouldn't dump a lot of pollutants on the neighbors. We should try to have to minimize them. And so they say, yeah, they maybe should be included in the analysis. But as I said, it usually happens at the firm level. I took a refresher, sat in just to see how the microecon course was taught 10 years ago at Augie during my sabbatical. And there, as in most of the places, 9/10 of the term is dealing with the firm level, and lo and behold, externalities were tossed in at the end. So in actuality, who knows what the economists do? But if we can think of this idea of externalities, should you introduce them into the model, one of the concepts that shows up is compensatory principles. That if you really would do the economics right, and here I'm going to use an example that came up, this is when it came most to my mind. Imagine that we've got somehow the street going here, and a street going here, and here is an intersection. There used to be a home here, and the rest of these are homes, and these are all homes, and someone wanted to put in a hamburger fast food place here. And these neighbors didn't like that, because instead of now looking at houses and bushes, they were going to be looking at the lights from a hamburger store, and in the summer, the winds from the south be blowing the cooking air toward them. Cars coming in and going out here. That means shining lights into these homes over here. But it was on a main commercial avenue, so they said, well, this is a commercial avenue. We should be able to convert that. And they said, well, that's going to bring in $1 million extra revenue to the city per year. The neighbors weren't so concerned about what it brings to the city. They know what was going to happen to their neighborhood. Now, if the economic analysis, and this is again from an economics book, if this were done correctly, that, and we even suggested this kind of privately, look at, if that's going to decrease the value of this home and that home and that home and these three homes here by $10,000 a piece, pay them $10,000. Add $70,000 into the development cost, then you gain, you get your business, and over the life of that hamburger place, $70,000 is going to mean nothing. The city gets the extra revenue, and these people are not impacted. Oh boy. That went nowhere. And the idea, the reason it went nowhere, is if we start doing that with every property, we won't be able to do anything. Well, there are ways economically where that can be brought up and it can be win-win. And there are some places where that is done. And I think that's a good way to think about it. So you're not expecting, in Rock Island, and some, I voted against that place. That was one of the few times, otherwise my fellow planning members and the commission members, there's word almost all, they're right together, good folks. I just felt sorry for these neighbors. At that point, I said, I'm signing them. That's their street. They've invested a lot into that. And knowing from what we know here that there was a way to deal with that. Distributive benefit is another economics term. Should the gain of a person or firm come at the expense of another one? And I think the answer there would be ideally no, and the economic texts say that it shouldn't. So in other words, even for that hamburger store, what really it was in my mind is that really going to bring in a million extra, or is that million extra going to come at the expense of Wendy's and Hardee's and McDonald's and every other place around so that it ends up with no net gain? Then you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. It says in the economics books that distributive benefits, as opposed to true overall growth, and there those are called allocated benefits, they should be included in fit cost analysis. But if you're simply moving or making you poor so these people get rich, then that really shouldn't go in the analysis for the city because it really is no net gain.
Like Walmart.
Something like that in many situations. This is a very tough one. And on this one, we talked about that in the Planning Commission in that very case. We had another one where a new hardware store went in, was voted in by my colleagues, even though within a mile we already had two good ones, one of which is truly a local hardware store. And some of my colleagues said, yeah, I don't know whether that section of Rock Island needs to have three hardware stores. But I said, then why are we going to dump again on another block of neighbors? And they said, but in America, we want to allow business competition. We want to allow people a choice. And I'm not putting that down. That's why I say this is a tough call at that point. That person who wanted to run Hamburger Place, they felt that they could sell more sandwiches, and therefore they should go in independent of what it meant for Hardee's and the others. It's a tough one. Very hard, situation by situation. And the last one, and that is what we call, what the economists call the discount rate. And this is risky to cover in a minute, that all that we have left. But basically, what the discount rate says that if you build, let's say there's money available to have a project completed next year, as opposed to, so you're putting $1 million in and that project or that benefit is going to come in a year. As opposed to if you put $1 million in the project and we're going to get the benefits in 10 years. Just like you think of an interest rate, you put money in and over time it's going to gain value year by year. The discount rate would mean that if you can get a benefit now, that's more useful than a benefit that would come in 10 years. So they apply a discount rate. So if this would be $1 million and it's going to take a year or two to get it, by the time you get it, in today's dollars, it may only be $500,000. So what if you use the discount rate, which makes good economic sense, but it always prejudices against the future? And now is where you bump into the environmental community then. Because that's saying that we ought to do this now, because that's the best economic decision. But if you say, no, I know it might be, but we want to make sure this is as good 30 years from now as it is now for our grandkids, they apply the discount rate, and it's of no value then. And so environmentalists push for zero discount rate. So whether you do something now, or 10 years, or 20 years from now, that's the amount that's got to go in, even if you're not going to get the return for 20 years, because that's going to be for our grandkids. Of course, economists and businesses will absolutely poo-poo that and say, and in that sense, if there were business people in the room, you'd probably say they're right. What business can go into business if it's going to be 20 years before you get the return? But people ought to be speaking up about that. And fortunately, the government allows usually that if you take a bank rate, the standard interest rate that we hear about. Usually the government takes something somewhere as a fraction, maybe half, maybe two-thirds between that bank-listed interest rate and a zero rate. And so it's sometimes called a social discount rate, something done by Fish and Wildlife Service, Park Service, Corps of Engineers and the other. It's a way of saying, yeah, we want to give it's a lower rate. Some people would say, look at that and say, that's ridiculous. Why don't they use the same standard rate that's used by banks? In part, it's because the government is saying the future does count. So again, what does that say for us as Christians? As long as somehow there are people speaking out that when the economic calculations are done, and there's a lot more technical terms, but when the economic calculations are done, that somehow the future doesn't take the hit. Because it will always take the hit otherwise. There is virtually no investment around that if you say it's going to take 20 years to get to that point, that's going to win out against something that will have a more immediate return. There are going to be people around the table who are saying, when we make our decision, even in strict economic terms, let's think for the future. Well, the last thing I want to wrap up, and I'm going to pass this around, and just about two more minutes of attention. Pass each of these around. This is the one that describes the model itself. This is one that I prepared for that presentation at St. Paul's in Davenport that has everything that we've had here in front of you. Pass that around. If we didn't have enough time, I didn't normally include this business about environmental justice, and that is who is impacted. And I may have a little bit of that tomorrow when we're looking at the common good. But this is a statement that was adopted in 1991, which is trying to say this environmental justice piece. I'll let these things get around and then we'll wrap up with a closing thought. So the environmental justice gets at the issue, and I may share a little tomorrow. It's amazing, the disproportionate arrangement where people locate things. Just one quick look at this. The blue neighborhoods here, this is in Los Angeles. You can see those are the ones with low incomes like this in this shade. And the dots that are here shows the facilities releasing toxic wastes. Notice. Not a one over here, and one dot after another. This is in Santa Clara County. Look at this one. This is the same kind of a thing. In this case, if you look at minority populations, the more purple or maroon you have, those are more minority populations, as opposed to the sandy color. And each dot represents a toxic release facility in the Los Angeles area. That's a whole other session. But again, geographers would be among those. If you go back to everybody counts, if you're going to need in your county 25 toxic waste treatment facilities, they ought to be maybe somehow distributed a little bit more evenly or randomly. This isn't just coincidence, they say. So when we then get to the conclusion of the session, and you've been really attentive, there's probable agreement in principle on many points. Love our neighbor, take care of the people that are down the way. Everybody'd say, yeah, that's good. But in reality, look at the problems that come up, and this is why it's really tough for all of us to get involved in this at all. Gee, the ethical issues, you're always like the gentleman, but you're always having to make choices. Which public? The near neighbors or the distant ones? At what point do the spatial linkages not count? Should the apple growers in Washington be worried about the apple growers who were put out of business in Michigan? Or should they be concerned about growing the apples here so there's more income and that supports local schools in Washington area? They're both. Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? Which neighbors? The current generation or the next? Yeah, people have to have business. They have to have jobs. And so you can talk, well, we got to worry about the next generation, but what happens if that means firms have to lay off 20 more people now? Or how about human brothers or sisters or plants and animals? This was a story in Thailand that they cut a lot of trees there. This is a number of years ago, but it's still happening. We looked at this fort, and it was supposed to be a protected area. And I asked the official that we were with, I said, but there were people moving into this part of the rainforest. I said, why are you allowing that to happen? I said, this is designated as a nature preserve. And he said, Professor, he was written directly, he said, Professor, you have to know, those are people who are cutting the tree because somehow they got to find a way to grow a few crops. How do you decide that? Am I going to be concerned about the orangutans and the other animals or that, or am I going to be concerned about those people? It's tough, isn't it? Or the majority view or the correct view. If you go to the perception, part of it might say we're going to go the right view, or the majority view, what's what most people want. But one article we sometimes talk about to say is to vote with the majority is a cop-out. Because that means if you know as a scientist that the majority wants to do this and that's going to mess up the environment, at that point you got to speak up and say, I don't care what the majority wants, I'm going to vote this because I know it's going to mess up the environment. It's easy for us to talk and hold and say that, but now what happens? You got a city council decision about that. Oh, it's tough. So we always have to make choices and somehow hope our choices are consistent. And what are the criteria? And that's the kind of some of the stuff we're going to look at tomorrow. But any quick questions? I know we got to get to supper, but we started at 10 after 4, so we finished here in 1 hour. So, yeah.
People, when you involve everyone, then as in Seattle, all you do is process, and you never make a decision.
There are ways to move things forward. It's real tough, though, in a democracy to do that. Tom Friedman, in his book, sort of Hot, Flat, and Crowded, he makes a wish. And he's very pro-American, so don't anybody misread, but he says he wishes America could be China for one day, and therefore just make the, and therefore if make the right decisions. Make the right decisions that have to be done, and then, as he says, America has shown that its decisions are made. We have great skills often at implementing and doing something. But let's just be that for one day, because we end up with, by trying to be democratic, everybody's views in, it's sometimes hard to get anything done. And we could add that as another dilemma. And that's what some students actually, they criticize the project. They say, Norm, how do you want me to be able to come up with a solution like that? If we consider all the stakeholders that you have, we're going to have pluses and minuses all over that chart, and we're not going to decide anything. So you're absolutely right. How do you involve?
Mayor Daley once in a while.
It's again. And that's why I have to say, look, this is just a guideline that at least get people to look at those different variables rather than just making an economic decision. Or some scientists saying, let science alone make the decision. This says you've got to think about all of them and try to bring it in. And so I'm trying to say, I think get some Christian perspectives on the table too. Yeah, one more.
Just quick, what day did we talk about carbon credits?
Here? Or if when?
Will we? Yes.
No.
Will we?
We're not. I'm not talking about global warming, because I know that's a huge issue, but I'm into other issues, and I think some of the other issues are not getting much treatment because everybody's talking about everything else, which is an immediate big issue, but there are some more important ones, so I'm not talking at all. And that's in a different class, so in my land use management class, we really don't get into that. I understand it, but we're not going to talk about it this week. Okay, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.